And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, it's the 41st anniversary of Earth Day. I can remember that first one.
Do you? I don't remember. I don't remember back that long.
I was in college, wear my moccasins, my Neil Young suede jacket with the fringe.
And what did you do to observe it?
Well, I think we just kind of walked around the campus.
Nothing.
Not too much. Well, today we discuss green energy, past, present, and future. Joining us is senior editor at The Atlantic, Alexis Madrigal. He's writing Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology, and he joins us from San Francisco's KQED Public Radio. Welcome to you, Alexis.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. You know, we largely think of the green technology and environmental movements as being very modern. What moved you to look backward in time to look at the beginnings of green technology?
Well, you know, at the time when I started working on the book, we're talking 2007, 2008, venture capitalists here in San Francisco and Silicon Valley had really moved into green technology and started to fund it in large numbers. And so as part of my reporting at the time, I was working for Wired Magazine, I wanted to find out where all these technologies that were suddenly getting all this, you know, millions of dollars were coming from. And I kept coming across these stories of like, oh, you know, new solar hot water system funded, used a design that first arose, you know, 100 years ago. And there were just so many of those kinds of stories that I thought, you know, no one's ever put this history together. And maybe I can be the one who's doing it, particularly using the sort of technologies that people are most interested in the venture capital world and kind of looking back and finding their antecedents. And what I found was that there was tons of history that had both been left out of the energy books and the American history books.
What's the most surprising features?
Well, I think the most surprising, I think, was the competition among car types like right around the turn of the century, like 1900. At that time, you could have called up an electric taxi cab and gone across the city of Manhattan with an electric-powered vehicle. And I think that particular story has a lot to say about why it is that people choose particular technologies, why things fail, why things succeed. And it's certainly one of the fast facts where people go, wait a second, we had electric cars in 1900?
So staying with the electric cars, what happened? Why did they fail?
Sure. Well, so the first organized car concern, like first car company, basically, was an electric vehicle company. And they were people who, you know, mostly financiers and people who'd worked in electric trolleys. You know, these are these trains that used to run all over basically every single American city. And they'd made their fortunes in electric-powered transportation. And so when they surveyed the scene, they saw gasoline-powered cars, which were really dirty at the time, very difficult to manage, went out of control. And there are these great statements from electric car advocates in 1900 saying, you see how dirty gasoline cars are. Imagine if there were millions of them on the road. You know, I actually think they probably said thousands. I don't even think they could have imagined that there'd be millions. And in fact, that's pretty much what turned out to happen. These cars contributed to major smog problems, particularly in the sort of large Western cities. I think the reason gasoline-powered cars won out over electric is it's sort of complicated, but we'll walk through a couple of factors. One is gasoline is pretty awesome stuff in terms of powering a 2,000-pound metal vehicle. It's what people call energy dense. You don't need very much of it in order to get a lot of power to drive the wheels of the car. So that's one. There's just sort of a physical advantage in some ways, and it's its own storage. You have all the fuel that you need can go right on the car for hundreds of miles. But a sort of underrated component of this is bicycles and bicyclists actually were a really powerful lobby in the 1890s. It sounds kind of crazy, but bikes were just taking off, particularly in the Northeast, and there were just millions, literally millions of bicycles coming to the United States, and they lobbied for roads in between big American cities so that bicyclists could go touring. And that turned out to be a pretty key development because at the time, there weren't a ton of roads connecting these cities that you could have traveled on a car. And so it's really, in some part, the bicyclists' work getting those roads paved and getting them ready for wheels that helped the gasoline-powered car to take off.
How ironic. But why wouldn't the electric one have worked just as well? I mean, you know, not the trolleys, but the cars.
Right. So the key advantage of the gasoline-powered car is the range. The hard thing for electric-powered cars at the time was that, you know, they had a range of maybe a few dozen miles. And so if you wanted to go in between cities, you would have needed the electric companies to set up charging stations along the way, like we're seeing happen now in the Northeast. And I think that's one of the big problems. Once they got the roads down, that particular kind of infrastructure was better for gasoline-powered cars than for electric.
Hmm. So let's move on to solar energy. It was a flourishing industry in California before World War II and across the land after World War II. What happened? Was it just not profitable enough?
Well, and actually in Miami, too, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Had a substantial solar hot water industry. Yeah, I think, you know, the story of solar hot water is a really fascinating one, because if we fast forward to today, what we see is that in China in particular, but also in Israel, that there are millions and millions of solar hot water heaters. And what we see in the United States is that there's very few. And this is a technology that was developed in the United States, perfected in the United States. You know, really, we're talking about 1910, 1920, where this was going on. And so what happened? And I think the key answer is that the best climate and the place where this was the hub of innovation was really Southern California. Solar hot water worked great, sunny climate, not that cold. And in that particular place, they also happened to hit a major seam of natural gas in around, I guess, 1905 or so. And so you had suddenly this pouring onto the market of this really, really cheap natural gas, which basically blew out the solar hot water pioneers. And it wasn't that the technology didn't work. It wasn't that it's not basically the same technology that's now used, you know, by the tens of millions. It was really just that really cheap fossil fuels have a tendency to be cheaper than anything else.
So what? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in particular, because, you know, you buy the heater up front, and that can be fairly low cost because they can make up the profit by selling you natural gas over time. And so it's sort of like how iPhones are subsidized now. And then, you know, your carrier like AT&T or Verizon makes money off you through time. It's a little bit of the same thing. They could sell you a really cheap natural gas water heater and then make money selling you natural gas, versus if you bought the solar hot water system, it was more expensive up front, but then you wouldn't have had to pay those recurring costs. But, you know, people like cheap up front.
Around the turn of the century and a little bit going forward, what about the power and lobbying of the oil, coal, and the early automobile industry?
They're pretty powerful. You know, it's tough. In this book, I went looking for a conspiracy. You know, I would have loved to have found, looking back, that there were like, you know, a dozen technologies and they were all really great. And if it just, you know, hadn't been for, you know, the dastardly oil companies, then, you know, we'd have this clean, green future, you know, or present. I think what you find is it's a lot more complicated. I mean, in addition to the sort of lobbying power of the oil companies, which got them sort of subsidized for a large portion of the 20th century, it was also just that people were solving a different set of problems. I think people didn't quite understand how burning fossil fuels at the rate that we started to would impact not just, you know, say, acid rain and the regional effects and local effects of pollution, but actual global scale effects like climate change.
Going back to something you just said about people like things cheap up front, you said that the crazy thing about human beings is that we build infrastructure around the low price and not the high price. Well, what would motivate people to do otherwise? Knowing that
I think it's part of it is the way we design our spreadsheets. Like I'm convinced, like the world runs on spreadsheets, and if you have people saying, "Hey, look, you know, this is going to be the price of natural gas," and they sort of model it in a particular way so that it's very inexpensive through time, it doesn't take into account the effects of those spikes, and so I think people really have to develop the kind of mathematical models and the sort of desire to try and model for things, for systems that are more resilient to that kind of price spike, which we know happens in fossil fuels all the time. And so one of the big problems, I think, is getting people – is getting the actual like conceptual and mathematical tools to price in that kind of thing so that we know that, you know, we're not basing all of our, you know, 50-year investments on the price of natural gas over the last 2 years. I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense given what we know about the volatility of fossil fuel prices.
So we need to be a little more farsighted.
Yeah, I think farsighted. And it really, I mean, I know people like laugh when I say, you know, we need like new spreadsheets. But it's really like if you look at the way a lot of this modeling is done, that's what you see. And, you know, recently we've seen these problems with the way that austerity rolled out across Europe on the basis of this report that had a simple Excel spreadsheet error, you know. And I think that's amazing that this type of tool, which most of us don't really ever see, that sits behind a lot of the forecasts and analyses that we see in the media, actually can have this incredible impact, whether or not it's a smart spreadsheet.
We're speaking with Alexis Madrigal. He's the senior editor at The Atlantic and host of The Atlantic's Technology Channel. His book, Powering the Dream, it's on Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we resume our conversation with Alexis Madrigal about his book, Powering the Dream. If you'd like to join in, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Alexis, getting back to World War II and what was thought to be going to be a solar revolution in the United States. Was it that the baby boom explosion had to aim at the housing crunch post-World War II for the returning GIs and such and not on energy savings?
That's another fascinating episode in our nation's history. I mean, people probably don't remember this, but in the early 1940s, like right as World War II was ending, you could have looked in the New York Times and seen all of these stories about solar homes. And people saw it as a veritable inevitability that after the war, people would take advantage of sort of new building materials and technologies and create more efficient homes. And it's fascinating because then, you know, what we get after that is sort of Levittown and a lot of the big suburban outlays that, in fact, were incredibly inefficient. And so people have gone back and tried to look into this. There's a historian named Adam Rome who spent a lot of time on this topic. And what you find is that a lot of developers didn't want to have to know the complexities of how to do solar siting. So you want, say, south-facing windows, right, in order to capture the most solar energy, or you want the sort of the kind of design quirks that you see across all vernacular architecture, like in the South and the Northeast, these different kinds of homes that were designed for their climate, you know, designed for specifically for the place in which they were built. And instead, what you get is this kind of industrialization of housing where people trade kind of design smarts for energy and materials. And it's a fascinating thing because a lot of the homes built right after the war are truly, truly inefficient. And part of that is the lobbying and the promotion of the utilities at that time who like to say things like the most important loads, like electrical loads, are the ones that we invent. And so they pushed really hard to push out air conditioning. They pushed really hard to push out electrical resistance heating. And these are two things. I mean, obviously, everyone loves air conditioning. No hate on air conditioning. But electrical resistance heating is a very bad way of heating spaces. It's an incredibly inefficient process. But the utilities pushed it because it helped them balance the load in the wintertime that air conditioning created in the summer. Hmm. And so you have a bunch of things going on in that mid-century that kill off the solar home that have nothing to do with sort of efficiency or the lowest cost for someone living in a home. They have a lot more to do with sort of industry structure and what made sense for the big companies of the time.
Alexis, how about your take on the future of petroleum as a fuel, particularly for transportation?
Yeah, well, you know, gasoline and diesel are pretty good fuels for transportation. And it's really, you know, in the past few years, we've seen the kind of difficulties of trying to build a bunch of different kinds of infrastructure. So if you look at what else could you do if you didn't have gasoline-powered cars? You could have electric-powered cars, you could have natural gas-powered cars, or you could have, say, hydrogen-powered cars. But all of those things require building this huge infrastructure network. And so far, no one really seems interested in doing that. I think one of the things you could see happening, you know, we've got all these big trucks going along the nation's interstates. You could see them developing, say, natural gas infrastructure for the big trucks along those big thoroughfares. Something like that, where there'd be a smaller, you know, you could see it rolling out along a kind of smaller, more niche application. But, I mean, just think of every gas station that exists, you know. I mean, it's difficult to imagine all of those things going away. I mean, that said, I think electric vehicles are sort of piggybacking along a kind of wave of science, material science, that I think is in a really interesting place in the evolution of its process. Basically, they're material scientists. These are the people who come up with all the stuff, all the actual, like, metals and, you know, salts that go into things. And they're now able to do a lot of that stuff in the computer. They're able to simulate a lot of these things instead of having to make it, you know, in what's bench science. And I think that's a really good development, both for solar and for batteries, which are kind of key technologies.
What if U.S. gas prices would get up to the level of Europe and other parts of the world?
It'd be interesting. I mean, I think what we saw, you know, when we had the run-up in oil prices a few years ago, was that there are certain areas of this country that only work if gas is inexpensive. If you look at those areas, say, to the east of Los Angeles, suburbs of Atlanta, there's a lot of places that are so spread out that for a lot of Americans, gas is a big part of their household budget. And if that doubles or triples or quadruples, then people are kind of sunk. And those actual areas are going to have a lot of difficulty. And I think this is one of the big problems when we're trying to think about infrastructure that's going to last for 30, 40, or 50 years. Do we really want to lock ourselves into a completely gas price dependent society? And I think one thing that's very heartening about this is that a lot of millennials, you know, this group of young people, want to live in denser cities where they have access to multiple modes of transportation. They can walk, they can bike, they can take public transport, or they can drive. And I think that particular turn of events is one of the most hopeful things for all of energy studies in the U.S.
I get the feeling that a lot of people, particularly in South Florida, which doesn't have a terrific mass transit system, that it would take a heck of a lot higher gas prices to get them out of their car and onto the metro rails and buses.
Yeah, I think part of it is, you know, thinking about the system. You know, it's not necessarily just getting them out of their cars. It's what are they getting out of their cars to go do? And I think one of the things we built in our cities is that things are really far apart from each other. I mean, I grew up in sort of ex-urban Washington State. I drove 50 miles a day from 16 to 18 when I was still living at home. And that was just to go to school and go to, you know, get food and basic things. And I think as long as we build communities like that, it's going to take a lot of energy to move people around, no matter what it is that you're using. And so I think, you know, one of the key levers here is to make cities attractive, make dense environments where people have easier access to the stuff that they want more available. And I think that's a big change in the environmental movement, to start thinking about things that way. Because, you know, it's not about living a Spartan existence. In fact, it's about living this very rich and fun life inside the cities, as opposed to, you know, a kind of pastoral dream of the country.
Which brings me to one of the, well, you have so many interesting characters in your book, but I'm thinking of Henry David Thoreau. You talk about 1833 Lowell, Massachusetts. You say it was a model of what the country could be, and nature, industrialization, and society coexisted peacefully. What did they get right?
Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, I see, when I went back into American history, I basically saw two models for industrialization at the very beginning, right when, you know, the U.S. is just getting going with industrialization. One is the sort of more British model, which is coal-powered, which is, you know, heavy pollution, and that sort of is represented by Pittsburgh. I mean, basically, people used to go to Pittsburgh and be like, wow, it's like staring at the gates of hell, because there were just so much fire, so much burning of coal. And people don't quite even realize this, but up until, you know, into the 1930s and 1940s, before they got all this legislation passed to clean up the air, Pittsburgh looked like Beijing. You know, I mean, it looked like those cities where people would never see blue sky for like months and months at a time. And I think it's difficult to imagine how gnarly that was. On the other side of things, you had Lowell, Massachusetts. And I think Lowell really represented a kind of better, distinctly American kind of industrialization. You had all these sort of Boston merchants who said, hey, you know, we want to start making cloth, but we know what's happening over in England. We know how bad their cities, the industrial cities, look. And we'd like to come up with a better way of doing things. And so they tried to reinvent the entire model of industrialization. They used water power instead of coal. They used a different kind of worker. They brought in lots of sort of young people who rotated through the factories. And not to say that this was sort of Shangri-La. I mean, people worked 12-hour days. It was rough. But it was, in comparison to Manchester or Pittsburgh, a much better kind of environment. I mean, at the same time, there were environmental repercussions because they were using water power. They had to dam the rivers. And so you have this really interesting moment where Henry David Thoreau, who's, you know, a kind of patron saint of the environmental movement, is going down the Merrimack River and encounters the dam that's feeding Lowell and is, like, upset about it. It's just fascinating because, for me, I actually think both characters, you know, the Thoreaus as well as the people who built Lowell, need to be included in our sort of environmental history. But really, it's, so far, it's been just Thoreau and the Lowell-type people who've been the builders of things, but also had more mixed results or not as ideologically pure, have been excluded.
Right.
Again, if you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Tell me, Alexis Madrigal, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Sure, alexismadrigal.com, just making it easy.
That's easy.
You had another one, and it says that's your old website, but you go to it and it doesn't redirect you.
Oh, it's true. Yeah, you know, I've had all kinds of weird hosting issues. Alexismadrigal.com is a good one.
Okay. Well, it's a fascinating story of wind power that you tell. It was a massive movement in the country, and it didn't have sophisticated scientific knowledge. Give us a brief history of all the wind power that used to be used.
Yeah, well, this is great. I mean, you know, where most people are familiar, I think, with the kind of farm windmill. You know, you've got, metal blades and, you know, it's just sort of, it usually says air motor on it, A-E-R, motor. And that was basically the end result of a couple decades worth of experimentation, innovation in building what was called at the time the American windmill. There were maybe 6 million windmills out there in the United States. And it actually, that makes it one of the most successful personal power technologies that really existed before the car. The fascinating thing about it, I think, I mean, beyond that, there was this sort of whole around Batavia, Illinois, just outside Chicago. There was this whole kind of Silicon Valley of wind going on out there for a couple of decades. I actually find a lot of the sort of DIY spirit of wind during that time to be the most fascinating part of the whole thing. You know, people coming west into Kansas and Nebraska, you know, crossing the 100th parallel, you know, it's really dry out there, really, really dry. And so they figured out, all these people working by themselves in different little towns and farms, figured out ways of tapping the wind through these various crazy contraptions in order to pump water out of the ground to sort of feed their crops and their cattle and their families. And I just think it's one of the great stories of kind of American innovation. These people literally building by hand out of whatever was, you know, out in the barn and creating workable windmills that were used to pump water. And there was a guy who was actually a dinosaur fossil hunter named Irwin Barber, who was like the official geologist of the state of Nebraska. And he went hunting fossils all over the state. And along the way, he encountered all these different types of windmills. And the reason we know that they even existed, because it's one of the few records that we have, is that he wrote up this incredible book that's kind of like a typology of all the different windmills that existed out there at the time.
And what was the book?
You know, it's on the USGS website. I think it's called Windmills of Nebraska.
Fascinating.
Catchy, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But they really are. If you see them, it's amazing because some of them are built kind of like merry-go-rounds, you know? They're sort of, so the wind would kind of push on them sideways and spin them. One style was called a battle axe, and it was sort of, it had these kind of two crazy arms that the wind would kind of catch and push. Others of them were, you know, shaped kind of like, you know, those old school water mills that you see sometimes, you know, where it's kind of, I think they call them an overshot mill. I mean, they just, anything that you could do to get the wind to push something,
right.
if you could get it to push a surface, they would transform that into a way to pump water.
Let's take a telephone call or two. First up, we've got Ginny. She's in Redland. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment and ask a simple question. I myself purchased photovoltaic cells for my house. I have 10 kilowatt set of panels up there, and I also purchased a solar hot water heater. I used to have a gas hot water heater. I have reduced my energy consumption by about two-thirds, but like people like to tease me that I just paid my energy cost about 8 to 10 years in advance because of the cost of the system. And I just wanted to, you know, I also have this fantasy that I could get an electric car and I could you know, put some photovoltaic cells on the roof for that as well to recharge it. But they're just so cost prohibitive, you know. What can we do to make green more attractive, going green more attractive?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting topic because, you know, if we look at the cost of solar cells, photovoltaic cells, they've really come down a ton, but they still remain really expensive, basically for the reason that you stated. I mean, you're paying for 10 years in advance. And most people, I mean, kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the top of the hour. I mean, a lot of people like things cheap up front. And I think, you know, the rejoinder is that basically you not only are paying less in energy costs, but you're also hedged against any, you know, fuel spikes. I mean, I think that's a kind of a key part of a resilient system. Mm-hmm. I think more generally, I think that we've seen the cost of photovoltaics kind of come down at a really steady rate over basically about the last 30 years, 40 years even. And because of that, you know, you kind of can say, well, you know, maybe in 10 years things will be easier. Maybe this, maybe that. But the really big innovations have been around the financing models for things. So a lot of people, particularly out here in California, have started using what they call solar leasing programs. So basically a company comes in and pays for the price of the panel, like the upfront cost, and then they basically sell power to you off of your roof. So people who want to go solar but don't have the capital to purchase the panels themselves can still go with that model, and that's been pretty successful here.
What's the best way to find out about those kind of offers?
I'd look at something like go to like Solar City or this kind of look up solar leasing. You can just Google that and you'll see that.
I like the topic. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Quan wants to know from Pembroke Pines, are there any environmentally friendly technologies that are less expensive to implement than their traditional counterparts? And how does the infrastructure cost affect the adoption of technologies such as electric vehicles, solar heating, et cetera?
Well, I think, you know, there's a whole long section of on this in my book, but the efficiency in general tends to be something that is adds to the balance sheet as opposed to subtracting. And we found this, you know, many times. I mean, there's a kind of the classic example of this. There's a guy named Art Rosenfeld who was a California Energy Commissioner, but before that he was sort of a scientist at one of the national labs here in California. And he was like, you know, refrigerators seem really inefficient, but maybe you would think that, hey, well, the more expensive refrigerators are more efficient and the less expensive refrigerators are inefficient. But when they actually tested all the refrigerators, this happened in the 1970s, they realized that there was actually no relationship between price and efficiency of refrigerator. And so what they did was they suggested to Governor Jerry Brown, again, now in the early 80s, they suggested, hey, why don't you just say mandate that all refrigerators have to be X's expense, you have to be this efficient. And it didn't change the market at all. Prices didn't go up. But all the refrigerators got more expensive, got more efficient. And those regulations rolled out across the country. And now Art Rosenfeld likes to say that that actually saved as much energy as we have installed nuclear power in this country. And so it's kind of an amazing it's an amazing thing what efficiency can do when deployed at scale against some of these you know, kind of low-hanging fruit kind of topics. And so you see this happening. Actually, you know, the leaders of this are basically most industrial companies. Industrial companies are ruthless about efficiency, and you see them leading the way in all kinds of ways. What was the other part of the question?
Oh,
the infrastructure cost.
The infrastructure, yes.
That's right. You know, I think the hard thing about infrastructure costs is who pays for it, right? Does the state pay for it? Do companies pay for it? Do you, you know, have a, you know, a bond measure? I mean, these sorts of things are really complicated. I mean, in the past for car infrastructure, like if you look at highways or you look at some of these things, the government put up lots of money for it. In the early days, that kind of early road building stuff that we were talking about, people lobbied, this good roads movement, as it was called, basically all the bicyclists lobbied for governments to pay for this kind of infrastructure. It's difficult, though. At this point, you don't see a ton of appetite at the federal level for like a massive new infrastructure program for electric vehicles.
And we'll move along to another caller. This is Kathleen. She's in Del Rey. Hi. Kathleen, you're up.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Okay, getting back to the question you guys asked about, or somebody mentioned about conspiracy. It really is a conspiracy theory, but I didn't really hear the gentleman mention anything about the fact that, you know, starting back in the 1920s through the early 1950s, General Motors, influenced also by Standard Oil, General Tire, they didn't really want the electric car or even the electric rail industry to continue. They didn't. They wound up, General Motors bought up over 100 train routes in 45 major cities throughout the country and let those companies sit there and those rails sit there and deteriorate so that they would be able to, along with, you know, Firestone, General Tire, the manufacturers and the oil companies, okay, be able to send these cars out there and be a massive influence and people have to buy them. You know, cities like New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, which had the largest electric...
Yeah, the streetcars.
Yep.
I think she fell off.
I think we lost her.
Yeah.
Which is too bad. There's a great response to this. Because there's a theory that a lot of people talk about, that this is, you know, one of the key things where corporate actors kind of destroyed the possibility of mass transit in America. And I agree that it is a massive lost opportunity that we used to have tracks all over cities in the United States. I mean, literally every city was blanketed with streetcars. And it is a great loss to our national infrastructure that those things are gone. I think we need to go one step back, though, because people initially saw cars as freedom from the streetcars. And I think there's a good reason for that. In a lot of cases, there's great books on this, particularly about Los Angeles. And there was a great episode of a podcast called 99% Invisible that dealt with some of these things recently, too. The rail car owners were, in fact, the major corporate actors. They were the people who were enriching themselves at the expense of the public. And the kind of classic thing to do was a real estate person or one of these guys involved in the streetcar conglomerates would go buy up all the land somewhere out, kind of outside the city, and then run a rail car out there. And then once the rail car was there, then suddenly that land would become more valuable, and then they would sell it all off. But they weren't building these rail cars in any kind of rational way for a transportation system. They were building it in the way to enrich themselves. So you kind of have this story is almost hilariously vile on all sides, because basically every actor in this case is building things to enrich themselves and not to create the best possible transportation network. And so what you have, with particularly with Los Angeles, it really, because Los Angeles had this huge rail network, it spread that city out way more than it might otherwise have spread. And so there, the rail cars, in fact, in some ways are part of the problem. And certainly as a, you know, as someone who sort of supports the little guy, people were really held over a barrel by a lot of these rail companies. And it's one of the reasons why people were so happy to rebel and get individual cars instead of riding mass transit, because they'd been so poorly used by the rail car makers.
And, of course, buses had the versatility to change routes.
Yeah, buses had... That's right. That's right. They had versatility. And at the time, you know, if you go back and you look at advertising at the time, you know, the buses don't look so bad relative to the old rail cars, which, I mean, goes to her point that they were allowed to kind of languish.
Alexis, you said that this is from Geo. You said that they settle on electrical resistance, heat generation, because they wanted to balance the load from summer AC to winter heat. What does that mean?
So, you know, if you're a utility, imagine what you've got. You've got all of these power plants that make, that like burn fossil fuels, generally speaking, to make electricity, right? And then electricity goes out. So if you imagine what that looks like, it's got, there's like a little curve every day, right? And the power goes up as people wake up in the morning, goes down in the nighttime. And on a yearly basis, that same thing happens. You know, when it's really temperate outside, you know, it's not too hot and not too cold, people don't use as much space heating or space cooling. When it's really hot outside, people use a lot of air conditioning, right? And so what that means is the electrical utilities have to design the system for what they call the peak load. So they have to design for when everybody has their air conditioning on. And so that means you need to build, say, 100 power plants that to match that peak load, even if on a day-to-day basis, you really only need 40 of them running at any time to meet the standard demand. And so if you're a utility, you want to maximize the usage of all those power plants. And so if you've got a, you know, 100 to match that air conditioning load, then you can make a lot more money if during the wintertime you have people using electrical heat as well. And so that's what they tried to do, and they made a lot of money doing it. And I think it's a key thing to understand why it's such a bad idea. Basically, when people just use fossil fuels in their house, they use natural gas or even wood or whatever, right? They're burning things directly there. So all of the heat that's generated is used to heat the house. In the case of electrical resistance heating, basically you burn it back at the plant, which had, say, you know, a 35% efficiency. You send it along the power grid, so you're actually getting less and less efficient. And then once it gets to the actual heater, you have efficiency losses again. And so by the time you look at that whole system, you're only getting a tiny fraction of the actual heat value of that fossil fuel want to actually heat your house.
We're speaking with Alexis Madrigal. He's the senior editor at The Atlantic, former award-winning staff writer for Wired.com. The name of the book is Powering the Dream. It's Topical Currents. Another short break, and we'll be right back.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Alexis Madrigal joining us from San Francisco. Alexis, in your opinion, what's the most important green tech event of the past 113 years?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I'm going to have to go with Bell Labs getting a fairly workable solar cell going, photovoltaics. I think, you know, if we think about going 100 years from now and we look back at these technologies, I think photovoltaics will be the one where we're just like, wow, that is so necessary to the way that we live now. At the time, you know, a way of producing electricity just from the light of the sun. Like, sometimes I think we don't reflect often enough on how awesome that is. And one of the best things about it, you know, it is a non-combustion form of generating electricity. And it's clean, it's silent, you can have it in cities. I think it makes a lot of sense for the kind of dense kinds of cities that we've been talking about. And the sort of what came after that Bell Labs invention and why it's important that it happened at Bell Labs is that they were tied into the whole rest of the sort of research infrastructure, which meant that in the space race, when people went looking for technologies to power things, they saw the Bell Labs work was right there. And it was, you know, not some far-flung inventor who'd been working on this stuff, but it was really like the hottest research hub in the country. And so you saw that technology getting developed more by NASA and eventually actually by oil companies themselves to power oil rigs to eventually where you get it to the point where many more people are working on it now.
Let's take another call or two. This is Jason. He's in Pompano. Hi.
Hi there. I was listening to your show. It's a great show. And a few years back, I had looked at just what it would take to have a business in the solar business. But one of the things I looked at was what does it really do for society? Because having worked in I worked for Bell, the Bell companies, we always operated on 5 nines of reliability. And our electric system works on, just like you said, peak power. And no matter how many people have solar power, we still have to build our core infrastructure for that day, that whether it's at night or whether it's during a storm or whatever, for that peak day. And that core infrastructure, that capital investment, will still have to be there regardless, because we don't have a way to store solar power. We
right.
have no way to it's, store it right now.
I think there's a really interesting kind of set of solutions. I think you're right in the sense that some of that infrastructure is going to have to be made. I think the question is some of that infrastructure investment. The question is, how can you bend that curve down so you have to build less and less of it over time? And I think, you know, some of the most promising technologies are this around demand response. So this is like, I'll just give you an example. You've got a really big warehouse that people don't go in very often, but the lights are on most of the time anyway for when someone does have to go in. They now have these kind of smart demand response systems that when the signal goes out from the utility that they need people to reduce the amount of electricity that they're using, it can turn off like every third light bulb or every second light bulb. And just it'll get dimmer in there, but on the other side of things, there'll be less draw on the electricity grid. And more people are signing up for this kind of demand response program just because it's like they get direct payments for doing it. And there are a lot of companies out there working on the kind of software side of this that's pretty exciting, where they're coming up with smarter and smarter systems for this kind of like automatic demand reduction. And I think, you know, I once had one of these kind of barroom conversations with a nuclear engineer who I quite like. I went to high school with him, actually. And, you know, he was talking a lot about how he felt like in the deep future, it'd be like solar, a little bit of nuclear, and then all this kind of really smart demand response that allowed people to move power really quickly on and off the grid.
Alexis, one thing you said that really surprised me, you said that the way the Endangered Species Act works is sometimes counterproductive. Why and what would you change about it?
Well, it's really interesting. I got into this because there was a big solar farm out in the Mojave Desert, which if you've never been out there, it's like almost difficult to imagine how vast and desolate it really is. And in the course of trying to build a solar farm out there, they have to do these kinds of surveys of like how many desert tortoises there were on, you know, X, you know, tens of thousands of acres. And so at a certain point, you know, you've got, this is like the biggest solar project. It's a bellwether for the entire solar industry if this thing can get built. And there was this massive environmental intervention. In fact, there were more people who testified basically against this solar farm then testified against any other power plant in the state of California. So this became this battleground moment. And it was something like 22 desert tortoises. 22 desert tortoises were holding up this entire thing with all kinds of, I mean, every possible kind of trick that you could imagine to try and stall this thing and make it more expensive so that eventually it wouldn't happen. And I think, for me, it kind of goes back to that Thoreauvian sensibility,
right?
Where you have people who, you know, don't want things built. They want to preserve, you know, what they think of as sort of unvarnished nature. And I think for me, looking, you know, reading those like thousands of documents and seeing all that stuff, it just made me think the environmental movement needs those same people to be builders and figure out how to come up with better systems, rebuilding these systems as opposed to preventing things from going in. And I think that was, that's where the Endangered Species Act becomes this kind of tool that can be used to stop anything, or almost stop anything, slow everything down.
Well, can it work hand in hand with environmental innovations?
I like to think so. I think a lot of it has to do with sort of the priorities of the environmental movement. I think it has a lot to do with whether local activists are interested in rebuilding systems or whether they have like other things in mind. I don't think you want to just toss out the Endangered Species Act. I just think that it's becoming clearer and clearer that there are going to be, if we want to build large amounts of renewable power in the United States, there are going to be trade-offs in terms of
just
the landscape.
A little common sense. Certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with Alexis Madrigal. He's the author of Powering the Dream, The History and Promise of Green Technology. Certainly been a very interesting hour, Alexis. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online, a producer. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, as well as author and book links, photos, and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like, won't you? Tomorrow's program is with a neurosurgeon who claims he experienced a form of the afterlife while in a meningitis-induced coma. He's written about it in the book, Proof of Heaven. To the calendar. On this day in 1896, 117 years ago, the first FEC passenger train rolls into the town of Miami. The boom was on. And on this day in 1976, 37 years ago, Barbara Walters becomes Network TV's first news anchor woman when she signs to co-anchor NBC News alongside Harry Reasoner. Harry wasn't thrilled. NPR's Susan Stamberg was actually first on radio. And one more while we consider the Big Three and tomorrow's big Game 2 NBA playoff game in Miami. On this day in 1988, 25 years ago, Miami gets an NBA franchise, the Heat. The name Miami Vice had been floated and dropped. They were originally in the league's Midwest division and won 15 games in 1988. Our theme music, composed by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from LeBron James, who averaged just under 27 points and 8 rebounds in 76 regular season games this season. Quote, "Being the only man in the household with my mom definitely helped me grow up fast." Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.